From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, filling in for Suzette Grelot, and welcome to Worldviews. My guest today is Matteo Mohamed Farzaneh. He studies and teaches Iranian history at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago and has just written a book about the country's early 20th century constitutional revolution.
In 1908, the parliament was bombarded, actually, by the Russian forces, which the Shah that had brought in to destroy this new democratic sort of an institution.
But first, I'll talk about President Obama's historic trip to Cuba with Latin American studies professor Alan McPherson.
It's the first trip by an American president, a sitting American president in 88 years, to Cuba. It really signals the end of the Cold War in Latin America.
We'll also discuss the president's visit to Argentina. The news is coming up next. This is World Views. I'm Rebecca Cruz. Well, lots going on in the world this week. We saw terrorist attacks in Brussels, in Cote d'Ivoire, in Nigeria, and elsewhere. But I wanted to focus this week on more uplifting news, and that was kind of how we started the week with President Obama visiting Cuba. I'm joined today by Alan McPherson to talk a little bit about that. Alan, this is a historic trip that the president and his family took. What are we to make of this? And, you know, is this really signaling a great deal of change between the two countries?
Well, it is historic. It's the first trip by an American president, a sitting American president in 88 years, to Cuba. Of course, it's, you know, I think Obama said it well in that it really signals the end of the Cold War in Latin America. I mean, he really wants to move beyond ideological struggles. And I think the trip as a whole showed this, both by going to Cuba and, in a sense, making peace with the left, and then going to Argentina, making peace with the right.
Well, you mentioned Argentina as well, so it's kind of a South American or Latin American trip. And Argentina and the United States have had somewhat tense relations for the last decade or so. They have a new president who's just kind of in his first 100 days or so there, and this seems to be an almost historic trip for the Obamas down there as well. What's going on with Argentina?
Well, Argentina very much is in transition. I mean, it's a very, very divided country between right and left, and those two sides have also, you know, opposed and favored the United States. And so it would have been too touchy for Obama to go to Argentina under the previous government. But now I think he really wants to show that a lot of problems with the Argentines have been resolved. There's the issue of the vulture funds, for instance, and that's being resolved now. And so I think Obama wants to show American businesses that Argentina is open for business.
Okay. So both Cuba and Argentina seem to indicate some positive trends for this administration. As you know, I think as the world knows, we are in an election year. Is this going to continue to move in a positive direction, or will our elections here potentially adversely affect these positive upswings in our relations with these two countries?
Well, I guess it completely depends on who gets elected.
Of course.
if Secretary Clinton got elected, I think things would move as they've been moving so far. I mean, she's, you know, one of the people in early on in the Obama administration who said, you know, let's acknowledge the past U.S. mistakes in Latin America, as Obama has done. But at the same time, let's not get bogged down in ideology. Let's move forward. Let's be pragmatic. And I think he's followed this throughout his 8 years as president.
And what has the reaction been in Latin America, not just these two countries, but elsewhere, to the Obama administration and specifically to this visit this week?
Well, I think Cuba has caused much more of a reaction than Argentina.
Of course.
Argentina is really more sort of an enclosed issue. But Cuba has been very important because Latin American countries really didn't want to have another large summit of the Americas with the United States unless Cuba were to participate. And that's one of the major factors that pushed Obama to renew relations with the country.
And where are we going in the next couple of months? We've kind of watched this Cuba situation evolve in the past year. What's the next step?
Oh, there are 1,000 next steps in Cuba. All sorts of things could happen. I mean, clearly there are some American investors who are interested in the island. But it's going to move probably more slowly than people think. Probably the fastest thing that'll move will be family visits, American tourists pretending they're not tourists, right? Checking the right box on the forms and going to Cuba. And so that'll bring some income to the island. But in terms of major investments and major changes to the Cuban people, we're going to have to wait a while, especially in terms of political changes in the Cuban system.
And is Cuba ready for this? Is the infrastructure in Cuba prepared for, as you mentioned, perhaps the tourism, the exchange, those sorts of things?
I think regular Cubans are ready for this. They've been really hoping for, you know, decades that something like this would happen. And now they're really starting to get a sense that the future actually can bring about change, which was not something normal in Cuba. But the infrastructure is not ready. I mean, they don't have the roads. They don't have the administrators. They don't have the bandwidth, right? So there's all sorts of problems to trying to run sort of a 21st century economy in what's really sort of a mid-20th century infrastructure.
Great. Well, we will definitely continue to watch this, and we appreciate you joining us today, Alan.
My pleasure.
Thanks. If you have any questions or comments about this discussion, let us know online at kgou.org. We're also on social media. Find us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, and you can follow Alan at AlanMcPherson1. Next, I'm joined by Mateo Mohamed Farzaneh from Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago for a conversation about Iran's 1906 constitutional revolution. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. This half hour, I'm going to talk with Mateo Mohamed Farzaneh. He studies and teaches courses on Iranian history at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago. He's also the author of the new book, The Iranian Constitutional Revolution and the Clerical Leadership of Khorezmi. Mateo Mohamed Farzaneh, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you are an expert on Iranian studies and are Iranian yourself. And so I wanted to start today with talking a little bit about a period of time in Iranian history that you personally experienced and has a connection here to the United States. And that is the situation with the Iranian diaspora after the revolution in 1979 and then in the 1980s. And you were one of these diaspora and came to California, as it were. You can maybe explain the backdrop of that and what compelled you to make that trip.
Well, Iranians are a minority group, obviously, in the United States, and they have a self-imposed sort of a diasporic experience. Many of the people that actually moved out of Iran after the revolution, they moved because of a variety of reasons, one being the feeling that they could not get to express themselves politically the way they had imagined before the revolution. And the second group are the people that actually moved out of Iran, again, not by force, but by sheer of their own will because of the Iran-Iraq war and the beginning of the war in September 22, 1980. And a large group of Iranian youth, men especially, they moved after a few years of fighting voluntarily in the Iranian mobilization force or the Basij. And after that, I was part of that group, which we were dismayed by the progress that Iran was not making on the war front and by the unilateral help that Saddam was getting from the West entirely.
This was
France.
An eight-year war. This was a long period of
time. This was the longest war of the 20th century, actually, which is the title of a book also. And it was a war that was fought between two Muslim nations, two neighbors that had a long history. Iran and Iraq have had a long history before they became modern nation states, as you probably know. Iran has had an extremely high level of cultural influence and political influence in Iraq, going back to the time of Cyrus the great Achaemenid king, going back to 6th century BC. So from Euphrates all the way to the Indus River basically was an Iranian cultural dominion, which has so far been the case even after the venture of Islam in 622, and after Iran became a Muslim society, or became part of the Islamic society, as part of the Great Caliphate, still Iran was extremely powerful and influential in the political institutions and cultural institutions of Islamic societies, and that goes on still even today.
And so this struggle between neighbors was taken quite personally.
Very much so. I'm from the southwest of Iran, from Ahvaz, and we got offended by the sheer act of violence that Saddam's army engaged in. And pretty much everyone got involved in the war, including men and women. Everybody kind of participated the best way they could. We had thousands of soup kitchens. We had thousands of women donating their rings and bangles for the army. We had old men participate. We had seamstresses, armies of seamstresses making uniforms and repairing boots and what have you. And we had the wealthy donate their money and trucks and bulldozers and what have you. And Iran was under extreme difficult conditions at the time. So Iranians kind of saw themselves kind of cornered, and they all responded the same way.
So certainly a difficult time, and you found your way to California and have become quite successful since then, becoming a professor and teaching and writing a variety of books. And a recent publication of yours looks at revolution, not necessarily the Iranian revolution in the 1970s, but going back a century and looking at the Iranian constitutional revolution. If you could maybe explain a little bit about what that was, what the situation in Iran was, and the who the important leaders were at this time.
It's important for everybody to know that Iran is the first Islamic country and the first country in the Middle East to have had a revolution, a constitutional revolution at that, in the 20th century for that, which created the Middle East or the Islamic society's first parliament or congress or constituent assembly, whatever you want to call it, that was based on a European model, which is very unique by itself. We know that the Ottoman Empire existed way before that for 500 years, and they tried to write a constitution in 1875, but it did not come to fore. And Iran actually was the first country to create a parliament and to write a secular constitution to a certain extent in 1906, and that revolution continued till 1911. And it was 2 years later, actually, that the Ottoman Empire succeeded in creating the same parliament in Turkey. Or in the Ottoman Empire, rather.
And who were the leaders? What were the issues that were at the fore here?
Iranians throughout all of the 19th century tried to modernize in the best way they could. And some of the Iranians saw modernization simply from the perspective of creating a society that is based on Western political values and the radical modernists, if we want to call them. They thought that the whole culture needs to be changed and westernized in order to progress.
Would that be secularized in some fashion?
It would be secularized. They would be just like Europe. People in Tehran would be people in Paris or in London for that matter. And that was a bit too much for a society that at the turn of the 20th century had only 2% of the population that could read and write. So the 98% of the population were under extremely difficult conditions, both culturally and education-wise, and they were under the spell of the Shiite clerics. Iran is 90% today of the 12 Shiite sect, and that was the case even then, although Iran has been very pluralistic, multicultural, multilingual, multi-ethnic, but Shiism has quite a bit of power, which goes back to 1501, when the Iranian dynasty called Safavid created Shiism as the national religion. So it was imperative that the religious establishment in Iran participate in this modernization or westernization of the political institutions. And that's what my book is about. It's about this certain Ayatollah or certain cleric or jurist that was of Iranian descent but had lived in Najaf in Iraq, today's Iraq, for the majority of his life, and he participated in the efforts and helped the modernist constitutionalists, which he could not really see eye to eye totally, but he did understand the fact that Iran needed to modernize, and one way of modernization and making progress was basically by creating a parliament, by creating laws that would be the laws of the land, in essence, that would put conditions on the arbitrary and sort of happy-go-lucky sort of a government that Iran had at the moment. So everybody saw that as a way to get ahead, to put the Shah or the king in his place and the courtiers in their own place, and everybody would be accountable to law, basically.
And this gentleman that you mentioned is the Ayatollah Khorasani.
Mullah Muhammad Kazem Khorasani. He is one of the most important figures even today in Iran. No one can get to the level, or any Shiite seminary, nobody can get to the level of Ayatollah without passing the tests that are basically designed based on his ultimate textbook, which is a textbook of jurisprudence. It's a text of methodology or juridical practice, if you will. So all the Ayatollahs today that are in power in Iran, Ayatollah Sistani, who is in Iraq, who is a very notable person in Iraqi politics and Iraqi society, they all have a very special place for Khorasani simply because of his book, The Sufficiency of Principles, which is called.
That's political scientist and historian Matteo Mohamed Farzaneh. We'll hear more of our conversation right after a break. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, filling in for Suzette Gerlot. I've been talking with Matteo Mohamed Farzaneh about Iran's turn-of-the-century constitutional revolution. Well, it sounds so interesting that you, as you mentioned, you had to bring in the religious component in order to get this passed or to have this come to fruition. How did Khorasani see these two things working side by side, religion and kind of a secularism or a politics and law?
One thing that I mentioned in the book, and I reiterate throughout the book, is that we should look at Khorasani or people from religious background in their own framework. They are clerics. They are not secular people. So for anyone to expect them to act as seculars or to think like seculars, that's wishful thinking. It's not going to happen. And vice versa, obviously.
Sure.
But they are common grounds, common denominators, where Khorasani could see that he could be helping a modern sort of a movement for the betterment of the society. One of the concepts in Shia jurisprudence is that the jurist, the person who is a spiritual leader of the community, has to have the interest of the people at heart above everything else, even above his own interest. So one of the ways Khorasani looked at it was, if I look at the interest of the people, in essence, I have to support a society that is law-based so everybody would be treated equally. Even the people that might not agree with the religious establishment as a whole, he thought they should have a voice in how laws are basically planned out and how institutions, Western institutions, are brought in, which makes him an extremely pragmatic sort of a person, but one that draws the line very clearly that if Iranians want to change their political systems, that does not mean that the social values that he and his other friends or other colleagues saw themselves responsible for, those social values could not be jeopardized under any circumstance. And I do have in the book tons of letters that he basically talks about that we're okay with this idea of bringing these ideas from the land of the infidels, meaning the West. We're perfectly okay with non-Muslims creating these things for the betterment of the society. But at the same time, we don't want their social values. We don't want them to poison the essence of the society and the essence of the market that we have in the society, which we will protect to the bitter end.
So having kind of the religious and the legal, keeping them to some degree separate, but also finding a way for them to go together for the betterment of the people.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned that this revolution, Iranian constitutional revolution, was 1906, 1911, thereabouts. What happened afterwards? Did the constitution, what happened to it?
Well, during those short few years, actually, from 1906 to 1908. In 1908, the parliament was bombarded, actually, by the Russian forces with the Shah that had brought in to destroy this new democratic sort of an institution, which was the parliament. So the parliament went into exile for a few months. And after coming back for the second session was a short-lived one, and that ended on Christmas Eve of 1911 when Russia actually invaded Iran. And not until before the beginning of World War I, 1914, Iran did not have a parliament, a working parliament. And after that, we do have World War I, in essence, which changes the formula for everybody, including Iran. And after the war, after the Versailles Treaty, in essence, Iran goes through a turmoil period where the Pahlavi dynasty are going to be propped up. Reza Khan is going to be propped up by the British in order to kind of trump the Russians, in essence. And Russia by that time had a revolution, and they had cleaned their hands off of any imperialistic practice that they used to be involved in. So Iran goes through the Pahlavi dynasty, and we know the story how that ends in 1979 with the overthrowing of the last Pahlavi dynasty king, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, which in essence brings in the theocratic regime of the Islamic Republic.
So history certainly threw some wrenches into the mix. But you mentioned that this is kind of something that is revered by the Iranian people, certainly today. And we know that Iran seems to be taking a new approach to the West, at least our relations or the U.S. relations with Iran seem to be changing. I think many would argue for the better. What can we learn from this period of history, from the Constitution, from the people involved that we can try to implement today or that Iran can try to implement today that will work in this context?
One thing that I think whoever listens to this program would be maybe thrilled to learn about Iran is that Iran is extremely flexible in undertaking new projects and trying new things to better itself. That's very important. And another thing for everybody out there that thinks Islam does not have the tools to create a democratic society, I think they're deeply mistaken, simply because this case, as my book kind of shows, within the Shiite jurisprudence, which I examine in this book, and I bring in concepts and values that are hidden, and some are implied, some are explicit in the works of Khorasani, we do have all the tools we need to have a establishment such as a parliament that's going to work independently from the religious establishment. But the challenge is that ever since 1906, the challenge is how are people going to support their representatives if the religious establishment were to come in to challenge those changes that secularists or people that were not necessarily religious-minded wanted to implement. So that's the challenge. So the two lessons would be that Iran is flexible, is very friendly to political institutions, but is not necessarily okay with changing of the social values or the family values that's included in there, or the values of the market, which is very, very important. The way we practice capitalism in the United States is sort of unique by itself, sort of like Adam Smith sort of a deal, which in Iran, which the religious establishment has always been involved in, works in a different paradigm altogether.
Well, certainly it seems like many lessons, and those that want to learn more about this can, of course, read your book, The Iranian Constitutional Revolution and the Clerical Leadership of Khorasani. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Matteo Mohamed Farzaneh, a political scientist at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago. You can read an excerpt of his book, The Iranian Constitutional Revolution and the Clerical Leadership of Khorasani, on our website, kgou.org. You can also find it on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU. KGOU produces Worldviews with the support of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre produced this episode, Miranda Wilson prepared the research for the interview, and Brian Hardzinski oversees our digital content. For Alan McPherson, I'm Rebecca Cruz.